It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
She picked him clean. He never missed it.
Remember that Sting experience? How good you felt? Now, The Sting, winner of 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, is back.
Chicago was the place to be in 1936. In those days, the big con was a dying art. Until a first-class grifter on the lam from the FBI and a young gaffer from Joliet joined forces to con the Big Mick.
He's not as tough as he thinks. Neither are we.
Paul Newman is Henry Gondorf. There wasn't a con he couldn't run. And there wasn't a sucker he couldn't gaff. Robert Redford is Johnny Hooker, a young grifter with plenty of moxie.
$3,000 on the red, Jimmy.
But he's a sucker for lady luck.
Tough luck, kid.
And a sap for lady love.
Thanks for the big evening, Hooker. Oh, next time you want to spend $50 on me, mail it.
Come on, would you?
Robert Shaw is the mark. In the underworld, he's the Big Mick.
Name's Lonergan. Doyle Lonergan.
It starts with the setup.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Then you bait the hook.
Your boss is quite a card player, Mr. Kelly. How does he do it?
He cheats.
You play him on the wire.
The wire's been out of date for 10 years.
That's why he won't know it.
Now he's ready for the sting.
He's there. Let's get on it.
Listen to me. Don't go back to your place tonight.
$500,000 to win. Lucky Dan.
Paul Newman and Robert Redford. This time, they might get away with it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and I am here, as is almost always the case, with my good buddy, Mr. Sean Whalen. Good morning, Sean.
I could not be more excited for this one today, so I'm glad to be here.
And Sean is excited because we are continuing our coverage of two Robert Redford movies in honor of his passing, and this one is The Sting from 1973. This may be, we recently did Butch Cassidy, and I said that has always been my favorite movie that he was in. But if I step back and I put on my reviewer's hat, instead of using the nostalgia of what I've enjoyed my whole life and whatever, I think this might be the best movie he was in. I don't know if it's his best movie, but I think it might be the best movie that he was in. And I think I'm giving away a little bit there as far as my review goes. I could have sworn that I saw this the opening day. I was just 11 years old at the time. And, you know, it was at a point where I was able to go to the movies with my friends. And I remember going to see it. And again, I could have sworn it was on the first day that the movie opened. But looking at the Wikipedia page, it said it opened on Christmas Day. So I can't imagine that I did that. The only time in my life that I went to the movies on Christmas Day was when The Godfather Part III opened on Christmas Day. And then after all the family festivities, about five of us went to see that because we were so excited about the fact that there was a new Godfather movie coming out. But that's the only time I ever remember going to the movies on Christmas Day, at least as a youth. I think there was one year during the pandemic, but like when, you know, things were going on and my kids were off with their mom. You know, I had spent Christmas Eve with them, so they spent Christmas Day with her and there was nothing going on. And I think we might have gone to the movies one time for that, but that's a totally different matter. And bringing this back, I saw this as, again, an 11-year-old with his buddies, not really knowing what I was going to see. And at 11 years old, I think a lot of the subtleties of this movie just kind of went right over my head. But I do remember laughing during it and coming home. And I remember sitting at the dinner table that night and my older sibling saying, "How was it? How was it?" Because it was apparently a buzz over this movie. And I was just like, "Yeah, it was good." But, you know, I have specific memories of that. It was probably in the week between Christmas and New Year's when school is out, is my guess.
This one, This one I saw in the 80s, and it was in my film class. In high school, I took this wonderful film class, and it went through. It started from the silent films straight on through till at the time, present day. And this was one of the spotlight films that was on there, and I had never seen it before. And I just remember being captivated. It was an example of one of those you couldn't finish it in one class session for obvious reasons. So we saw this over three class sessions. And I just remember when it would stop, like wanting to see the rest, needing to see the rest. It was that kind of film. Then, you know, this was one of those I owned, you know, right afterwards because of the just how I felt about the film. It's one I haven't seen in a few years. So when I watched it this time through, in a great way, there was a lot of it I forgot. I watched it actually last night with my wife. It was a joy to watch this film again and to see every surprise that happens in it. I knew where things were going. I knew how it ended. But the journey, this is an example of where it's not the destination, it's the journey, and how you get there is so well executed that this is a film I'm so glad we're going to be talking about this today. If I did not have this strangely on my desert island, you know, if we're like stuck on an island movies, it absolutely should be there. It would bump out other films. It's definitely would be in my, it should be in my top five. I'm spoiling the lead a little bit on this one, but I want to say that now because we did that recording on that. I got to go look back at my list to see if I somehow omitted this one, I would bump something for this.
I'd have to look at my list again too, but you know, I did give the disclaimer when we did that if you asked me 15 minutes later, I might have given you a different list. Mm-hmm. So I'm not concerned about when I say all this. This one's one of my favorites now.
I think this one, though, is for me the reason why I'm noting it. It's one of those films where after seeing it, I'm like, oh, no, I could not go the rest of my life without seeing this one again.
So you're sitting there saying, how could I have left this one off?
If I did. I don't remember if I did because it's been a while since we did that recording. This one should be. This is that kind of movie.
I think I included Butch Cassidy on that list, but I don't think I included this because I wasn't going to put them both on it, which is probably not fair to them, but I'm pretty sure that was my thought process. So I don't think I had this on my list back then, but it certainly is of a quality. And like I said, 10 minutes later, I could give you a whole different list and I'll say this is of a quality that at any given time it could be on that list.
I know I had The Natural on that list. That's why as we're thinking Redford right now, I'm wondering if I omitted this one because of The Natural.
Yeah, when you put together a list like that, I don't think it's probably, you know, again, it may not be a true list of your absolute favorites, but I do think on occasion you say, well, this is already represented. So, like I said, by having Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid on my list, I think the Sting was, you know, the Robert Redford, Paul Newman movies were represented. So I didn't need to put them both on. Again, unfair probably to the actual place where this one lands in the film pantheon, but just the same, you know, there's so many things you want to include that you feel like you have to kind of make some vicious cuts on some movies that otherwise could belong in there. Because reality is, I think we did our top 30. There's probably 100 movies in my top 30.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, easily.
So this definitely goes somewhere in that overall list. I remember one of the big things about this movie when it first started was that the ragtime soundtrack was a little bit of a cultural epic thing. All of a sudden, people had never heard ragtime music before, and now all of a sudden it was like, oh, I love this. This is, you know, it's so bouncy and fun. My understanding is it is a little anachronistic because ragtime music was actually bigger in like the 1910s, and this movie is supposed to take place in the 1930s, I believe. So it's not really timely to the movie, but it's definitely, it creates a feel for the movie. And I think that feel is 100%, you know, a bullseye.
One of the things that I loved about this film was, to your point about the 1936 film, it was the ragtime music was met with this framing. It had in the background those little title screens that like told you the chapters of the film. Yeah. And everything maintained this theme of classic films. I almost could hear the film loop running with what they were trying to do with it to take you to a time. And it stayed throughout the film. The music for that, the ragtime that opens up in the beginning, never lets go. And that was something that really, this is very atmospheric as a film and sets you to an era. And I love that aspect of the movie. That's something where I think it gives it its own place because of what it did so well with that.
Yeah, it's definitely a period piece. Mm-hmm. And I think they paid special attention. I can't definitively say that they paid special attention to everything to make sure it fit the year that the movie is supposed to take place. But everything in there definitely fits the feeling of the period that they're trying to create. There's nothing that feels off. And so it's a funny thing about period pieces, though, how, you know, by putting it in a certain era, it makes it timeless. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's the case here. I think this movie is pretty much timeless, that it, you know, it hasn't aged in the 50 something years since it came out. Watching this a couple of days ago for the sake of doing this today, it didn't feel like an old movie. It felt like a movie that took place in an older time, but it didn't feel like an old movie. I think, again, like I said, I think the combination of the music, the acting, the story, everything about it seems to fall into place to create just a feel independent of the time that it comes out.
Yeah, and that's something that's hard to do, because I don't think you intend to do that when you create a film. I don't think you intend to think about, like, what is this going to play like in 2025? They're looking to create a good movie that is relevant right then and there when they're doing it. And this is one of those examples of a film that I would have no problem. And I actually did last night. My wife had seen it for the first time. And, you know, it was one of those where I had no problem showing another person. And I didn't feel like I had to do a major setup of, you know, hey, this is a film from this era, that type of thing like that. The film just takes you right where you want to go with it. And it's cool. I'd be remiss if I didn't say that about this film. It's still cool today. And there's not a lot of movies, you know, we've done this for how many episodes together now? There's not a lot of movies that come back and said, man, that movie was cool. This movie's cool.
Well, this one, I guess if you had to pigeonhole it, and I don't think it would be really appropriate to pigeonhole this movie, but if you did, mm-hmm. I think you're looking at, you know, this is a caper movie. Yes. So you're looking at, you know, if you're looking at other movies of its ilk, you're looking at the Ocean's 11 movies, and you're looking at, you know, Death Trap that we did, and, you know, like different ones where there's twists and turns that you have to figure out as it's going along. Now, the first thing about those movies, in my opinion, is you can't just throw stuff out of left field. If you're going to give me something, then have it be, have it had been, or have it having had been, whatever the may, whatever the proper terminology is, have it set up as the movie goes along. Give me a Chekhov's gun, and then at the end, let it pay off. And then it's up to me. Did I notice it when you did it? Did I figure out that you were doing this? I think this movie, on the, you know, the first most important part is, I think it's all very fair about that. I don't think it cheats. So when it's all done, I think, you know, that's important. But that's only part of it, because if that's the case, then you have a movie that is really fun to watch once, but, or maybe twice, to then see if there's the cheats in it. This movie goes well beyond that, and I think it's largely on the charm of the actors, the feeling that it gets kind of set throughout the movie, just the, you know, the era and the, you know, the story itself. And there's just so many things about this that are fun to watch, that if you're, you know, even if you know exactly what's going to happen, which, believe me, I know, I've seen this enough times, I know every little twist and turn in it, it doesn't matter. It, you know, the shock value isn't what's important. That's what that's one of the things that makes it fun at the end, is, you know, okay, they got Lonergan and they got Snyder, and they, you know, they pulled it all off. But when you're watching the performances and you know how they do it, it's just so much fun. And there's a lot of actors in this that are fun to look back on now, because, you know, who they were, or, you know, what other parts they played and where you know them from. And, you know, start right off at the beginning. You got when they do the scam on, you know, at the very beginning, the Robert Redford's partner in it is Robert Earl Jones, James Earl Jones's father, who I was not familiar with, but he also has a cool voice, just like his son.
It's funny. I didn't know when I was watching at this time that that's who it was, but the voice is unmistakable. So I mean, it sounded like James Earl Jones in all of the right ways. And I just loved every bit that's who it was. 'Cause I looked after watching it again, like, who is this? And their chemistry is a big thing in this film, because it's easy to lean heavily on the apparent chemistry between Newman and Redford in this, but there really is a strong cast in this. And that chemistry in the beginning is critical, because you have to believe this guy was mentoring him, and almost like a proud papa was like setting him on his way, you know, saying, hey, my day is done and I've peaked, but I see you as going, you know, farther than I ever did. And I'm almost holding you back from where you can go. You're going to have your big score. And the whole thing was just really cool between the two of them. And you got to care about him in the beginning, because with what happens with them, where things start to go sideways because of the scam that they just pulled, you've got to care when he dies. And that character in a very quick period of time is established as somebody you care about because of him and because of how they introduced his family. I thought it was just a really good sequence with him, not only the original scam, but then the moments where we got a chance to see them in their home. We got a chance to see, you know, how these guys are as comrades afterwards. And I loved everything about his portrayal. Because it's not a throwaway character. You lose that character, you're going to lose some of the motivation of Redford's character. And you've got to want that. You've got to want him to win at the end. And you've got to have motivation for it. And you've got to feel him. And it was so well played by all three of the actors that were involved in that little group from the initial scam. That initial caper was pretty cool.
Oh, definitely. And to be, you know, I mean, again, I saw this when I was 11 years old, but when I first saw it, I had no idea what was going on. And I don't think your average person did. I don't think it was obvious that they were scamming this guy. Mm-hmm. You know, you're sitting there and you're taking a let's wait and see attitude. And then when they show you basically, you know, it's so clear once he gets scammed to know how they did it.
Yes.
That it's to me, that's wonderfully constructed. And then just, it's worth mentioning the guy who they scam there is James Sloyan. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And he's definitely like a that guy, you know, somebody you've seen in a million things. But I know him mostly as Odo's human father on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
It was great to get some background with him before he gets scammed. And I loved that he didn't help him. So the guy's screaming for help. He's like, you know, I'm being robbed right now. And I love that he just kind of watches all this go on. It helps because you see where it's going with the money. You know that he's just going to take it and head off in the cab and not go where he's supposed to go. And Redford points it out. You know, he's like, I don't know if you want to trust this guy. I'm not going to do it because, you know, hey, they just saw my face. So it's not for me, but I don't know that you want to trust this guy. And the $100 and he does everything to sell it that he is the guy that's got to take this money and he's going to take this money and run. I love that the two of them had no idea the score they were going to get here. They knew they were getting money off this guy, but they had no idea it was going to be an $11,000 score. And that's the funny part of this film when you're seeing it.
I think that also, I'm sorry.
No, it's good. $11,000 is looked at as this monumental amount of money. Don't get me wrong. It's not a throwaway today, but it's certainly not what it was when this film came out. And that's where I think the timeless nature of the film helps as well, because it gives you the sense of scale with monetary amounts.
I think the one of the factors in all of this, as far as that goes, is the fact that they didn't know how much they were scamming this guy for. Mm-hmm. Kind of shows a little bit of the reckless nature of Johnny Hooker and why he needs to be schooled a little bit on how to do things and how to do it. And that's kind of carried through the movie. I don't want to get into Redford's performance just yet, but his character is shown as somebody who's hit a certain level in his chosen career path of grifter, but needs some schooling from somebody a little bit more sophisticated. And that's why, you know, they got to do the big con. And I think that gives the character more depth. And you see that come up again and again, you know, how he blows the money so easily. And you know, how he has, you know, there's the hit on him, or the contract on him, and he's not letting everybody know what's going on. He's keeping the information to himself instead of letting it be known. But, you know, luckily Paul Newman's character is sophisticated enough to see what's going on and puts a bodyguard on him, which ultimately saves his life. But, you know, it shows you why Johnny Hooker needs that mentoring.
Mm-hmm. Luther, as a mentor, he's known fondly, actually, by Newman's character, Henry. He's fondly known as a very talented street scammer. And so it's done with respect. They respect the score and the fact that they do that, but you can see how being a street scammer, it's a celebration of the quick fix. You're never pulling enough money from a street scam where you're going to be set for life. These are scams where they're going to buy you a certain amount of time to be able to keep, you know, operating and functioning and living life and all that, but you got to keep doing it. And Luther's looking, you know, he's at that stage where I'm ready to retire from all of this. And I loved that sense of Redford's going for the next level. He's pushing Redford to the next level where he never got to. And that idea of graduating from these quick fixes, which I think his recklessness comes from that. Like, it's always every day's a celebration when you do with these scams, right? Now I'm set. Look at me. I'm big time. And yet you're not, because the score is not enough to set you up. And
but this score, apparently, in that day and age, was enough to set him up. That's why Luther said, I'm ready to get out.
Yes.
And Johnny Hooker just blew it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, he's like, but you know, you have that initial scam, which again, I thought was put together extremely well. Then you have him blowing the money, and just, you know, worth mentioning, the girl who he goes with there is Sally Kirkland, another well-known person. And then in the club where she's dancing, on the stage is one of my favorite character actors, Leonard Barr, who I always like to point out is Dean Martin's uncle. But then, you know, so you have a lot of setup of his character. When he blows the money, that's showing you his character. And it's also showing you his recklessness, because he's blowing it and getting scammed, and he should know better. So, you know, there's that whole aspect to this thing. So, you know, you see, again, his recklessness. He's a very likable character. He's very, you know, he's Robert Redford. He's extremely charismatic. You automatically want to like him. But you're also seeing that he is reckless enough, and that he's going to end up like Luther if he doesn't kind of wise up. So this movie... Again, I don't want to get into his performance just yet, and I'm doing it whether I like it or not, apparently. But, you know, there's a whole character arc for his character through this movie. You know, there's a whole thing where, you know, he's learning and he's developing and he's getting to a certain point. And, you know, we will get to that, I guess, as we go along.
It is an example of great world building, because of the fact that all of these actors that you're pointing out that he's encountered along the way, they're high quality talent that are just crafting this world that he's going through. And we get to see the various stages of his life through his interactions with others and how they view him. If you're one of the reasons why I think you're being pushed to start referencing his performance is because each of these touch points were deliberately put there for us to learn more about Hooker's character. And that part's really done brilliantly. Because all of the bit characters in this one, I'm going to put quotes around the bit characters, were really crafted to help us get to know him. And it works exceedingly well.
And I think you hit one of the nails on the head. I think there's so many nails here, but I think you hit one of them on the head, saying that even the bit characters all add to it. And I'm just going from the scene where he blows the money now, and you have... Again, Sally Kirkland, you know, with the next time you want to blow money on me, just send me the money. So you're seeing a little bit of their relationship. You know that they're not, you know, it's not like the love of his life or anything like that. It's just somebody who he's killing time with and trying to have fun with. And, you know, she's probably looking for more. So, you know, you kind of get a feeling there, even though it's such a short scene. And then he goes to Luther's apartment or house or whatever it is that he's living in. And you're getting a lot in a very short time. You know, you get that his wife, who's going to church, used to be his partner in running these scams.
Yes.
So, you know, these feel like real characters. They're not just, you know, there for a second and gone. Even though she's got a very short scene, you know, it's important. And it plays, it shows you the tapestry that this is built on. And I think that's a real key to this movie.
And her history is something that is never a throwaway. Like I mentioned how great that family was in the introduction to them. It sets the stage because of his fondness for them. And because we get to know that, oh, she's a part of all this. She knows what all this looks like. It plays later on in the film in such a pivotal way when he has to make some choices. And as a viewer, we think he's got to make some very difficult choices. Because you care about her already, you're carrying along with him when that she's dropped in front of him. And she played a great part, both in the introduction of their relationship, you know, meaning Robert Redford's with that family, but also the reaction to Luther's death. You know, all of these pieces added to this emotional resonance that happens very quickly. The whole Luther arc is very, very quick. But it is pivotal and important, and it's got an exclamation point to it because it felt very real in that sequence and tugs at the heartstrings. And that it's critical for that.
You also get a little bit more of Hooker's character, because even though he blew the money, mm-hmm. he doesn't, you know, he takes responsibility for it, and he, you know, he doesn't try and cheat his partners in any way. He gives them their share. He didn't gamble it away trying to win more. You know, there's, I think, you know, he's got a, it's kind of the honor among thieves thing, but he is definitely an honorable character. He's, and I think that's important to an extent, not because he knew he was doing it, but when he did do the initial scam, he didn't do it to a good person who was trying to feed his family. You know, because then that's something that could turn you against him. They want you to be rooting for him the whole time, and they want you to see his, you know, his charisma and that he's the star of this movie, really.
He's a thief. I mean, it's, there's no other way to look at it. But it is an example of where you can romanticize stuff like that and make it really, really good. And there's that edge. You know, it's an edgy film. And when you can manage to keep that same feeling of an edge in 2025, that's a victory. With this, Robert Redford, it's funny, we did do Butch Cassidy and Sundance. And, you know, I've always loved The Natural and things like that. It's amazing how much of a cool factor he has as a character. It is later life, you know, when you got to see some of the films he was doing, it wasn't this type of movie. But when you look early on to his career, he is somebody who is, I mentioned almost with Butch Cassidy and Sundance, and he was kind of like a Wolverine kind of character to use a comic reference. And I just feel like he does, when he walks into a room and he's playing cool, that works really well and likable. You believe that friendship matters to him. You believe that loyalty matters to him, which in this world where you're cheating others, that having a code of some sort and feeling that code and seeing that he has a line is something that's pretty important to liking this character and wanting to rally behind him, like you're referencing. And I think that's something that never gives up in this film. Even when he makes mistakes, you're never ready to scold him. You're rooting for him to get back up and to succeed. And that really is key for this ride and this journey. You've got to be on one side. If you're flip-flopping on sides, you're going to lose something in this film. Because some films work well when you can, you know, do that flipping act. This one doesn't make sense to you. You've got to be rallying for him the whole time. The good guys are the good guys, and the bad guys are the bad guys. And sometimes it's great to have a film that just has that at its core, and it works.
I agree totally. And I, you know, we've talked about this before. I'm a soft touch when it comes to these movies, and I want to root for the hero, and I want him to be somebody who I can root for. And sometimes it's hard for me, and I'll go to, you know, Breaking Bad or The Sopranos or even The Godfather, you know, the Al Pacino's part in it at least, where I want to root for the heroes in the movies, but I have to see through to their dark side and that they're not good people really at heart. You know, and some of that is very, very layered and deep when you talk about the three examples I just gave. In this, it's easy to root for Johnny Hooker. He never does anything that you would consider to be reprehensible. He never does anything where you say, oh, that's not right. Even though he's a grifter and he's cheating people, he's not, you know, again, they don't show him doing it to a bad person, a good person, rather. If they showed him, again, ripping off somebody who was, you know, had just worked a 12-hour shift trying to put food on the table for his kids, and then Johnny came and took all the money, and this guy's kids were going to go hungry that night, now you have reason to root against Johnny. But in this instance, you know, he's this guy's just a money runner for the mob. So it's like, yeah, fine, rip him off, who cares?
Sometimes when you have that constant in a film, it's the characters aren't as layered. So it's funny, I think the references that you're throwing out are appropriate because these are depth-filled, layered characters that you're referencing. He is just as depth-filled and layered as every character that you reference there. There's the nuances there with him. But he is just this, like, because, I mean, he's a thief, you know, at the end of the day. I mean, it's something that we've got to, you know, throw out there with him. But he, as the movie goes on, and you get to know more and more about him, and he is faced with more and more circumstances, I think you get that same layering with this character. And I think that's a victory when you can still, throughout the beginning to the end of the film, still feel like he's the good guy. And yet you have not sacrificed any of that depth. in order to do that. This film has got a lot of depth and a lot of character drive and a lot of character storytelling for everybody that we're referencing here. Because we're touching on Redford. We barely even touched on Newman. And I mean, that tells you a lot about a film when we've been tap dancing Redford, like barely touching the surface of Redford. And we got Newman still to discuss in this whole thing. And that's where I think this film really succeeds, is layers.
And I think we've tap danced enough. I think we should touch on Newman a little bit, because then I want to get into the interaction between the two of them, which I think is truly the heart of this movie.
I agree.
So my understanding is that Newman, I think he enjoyed his time with Redford so much, whether it was on a professional or a personal level. And I do think there's a personal thing. I think they, as I understand that, I do think they became good, very good friends. And I think they wanted to work together. So I think he lets himself take the secondary role in this. It's not a small role by any stretch, but it's definitely secondary. I think, you know, Redford is really the star of this movie, and Newman is a very, very close supporting star. He's almost the star, but he's not quite there. He did get top billing, but you know, that's okay. But he took a kind of a backseat, and I think that does go against his business acumen to some extent. I mean, when we talked about the Towering Inferno on the show, we talked about how he and Steve McQueen needed to have equal everything, equal salary, equal number of lines in the movie, equal billing, everything about it. So he did have a certain, I'm not going to even say ego, but a certain amount of feeling like he needed to be presented in a certain way. And I think he took a little bit less in this one, because I think the part was so compelling. This movie was written by somebody who had just done some research on the grifting and scams that went on. And I thought that was an interesting thing that he decided to create this from that. And, you know, turned out to be a great script that apparently, you know, could have easily not gotten made. So, you know, somebody saw it and they went with this. Two casting things that I think are worth mentioning is the part of Gandorf was apparently offered to Jack Nicholson, who turned it down because he had a greater interest in doing Chinatown and Five Easy Pieces, which, you know, not that those are any poor movies in it at all, but he gave some sort of comment that, you know, of course he knew this was going to be a big hit, but he just had these other things on his plate that he wanted to do. It's interesting to think of what he would have been like in that role. I think he would have been good. I don't think he would have been Paul Newman. So I don't think the movie would be as good, even though I think he would be excellent.
You would have lost some of the chemistry. And he's an amazing actor. I'm a big Jack Nicholson fan, but the chemistry between these two is the key. It's funny, something you referenced earlier about Newman kind of taking a different sort of role in this one, in the sense that, especially for this era, where you got to protect your brand, right? I kind of get the whole motivation of, you know, your name. In Hollywood is how you make your money, right? If you lose your spot and you start taking a back seat to other actors, you're no longer that top billed guy. You're no longer pulling that top billed money. And our understanding of what money looks like in Hollywood today was different than what it was here. It was still big, but I mean, it obviously had significant jumps along the way. The importance of keeping that spot had to be huge. Whoever, whether there was Newman alone or Newman and a combination that recognized what this character needed to be and how it needed to interact with Robert Redford's character, was pretty critical here, because I think it does the film very well. It does the acting very well. It does Newman's character very well, because I think he's very endearing. You've got to care about him from the get-go. His introduction was stellar, because it was a moment. And there's so much about this film that was a moment. Right from his introduction, you're captivated by these two. And I, that a lot of that has to do with Newman's portrayal of this character, who brings an experience to his table, to the table of this whole piece, where, you know, now Redford needs another mentor. But again, it's another mentor who is working off of what Luther saw in Redford's character, this talent. So you need this sense that Redford being involved is going to take a score to a different level. They see something in him that takes him, that's going to take this to be something that they couldn't have done without him, because he brings that to the table. That's the shadow that, like, kind of follows you throughout the film. Luther sees him being something more. Luther sees him being something more. And then we've got Newman's character, Gondorf, seeing him because of what Luther said and how much he respects him as being something more. There is a continuity of that timeline that is having us as the viewer wanting to see Redford do that, like, amazing score. This thing that you're not going to see if it isn't these two together doing this really cool score. And I think the film gets you to that hook. And I think that is the ultimate hook. You want to see, what are they going to do that's just going to be so cool that you're like, wow, that is a different level kind of score in what they put together. And I love that. I love that feeling all the way through. You believe it, and you believe that they believe it's going to happen. And we're Absolutely. Going along with them. We're part of the crew. And I think that's something that the film does very well. You, from the start of the film, are a part of Redford's crew. You move with him from Luther to Gondorf's crew, and you never let go. You never feel like you're outside of it. You never feel like you want to jump sides. You want to be with that crew, and you want to see that crew succeed. And it's an important part of this movie, because I feel that's where the satisfaction is at with how this goes, beginning, middle, and end, is that you're a part of that crew. You cheer for them when they're winning. You get worried when there's a potential for failure. And that's something that it pulls at the heartstrings. This is a really, really one of those movies where I think you get emotionally invested fast. And it's fun.
I never thought of it from the perspective of you're part of the crew. And as you're talking about it, I'm thinking that's 100% right. And you know who you are in this movie? You know who your point of view character is? What's his name? The Erie Kid.
Yes, yes. Because
he's the lesser experience. He's involved in the scam, but he's not quite as at the level that these guys are. And he just desperately wants to be a part of it. So it feels like he's almost your point of view character. Mm-hmm. And I had never thought of that until you just brought that up. So that's an interesting perspective of it. I had one other casting thing that I wanted to talk about, but we're going to get to that because we're not up to that person yet. I want to talk a little bit about the interaction between Redford and Newman, because I think that it's critical to the movie, but it's also critical if you're sitting and saying, well, I'm going to compare this to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Oh, they're just going on doing the same thing. Far from it. This is such a different dynamic between the two that if you watch them together, if you watch them, you know, within a short time of each other, you just see you see the same actors, the same charisma, the same likability, but very, very different dynamic between them. In Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, they're pretty much equals. There's parts where Butch is kind of the boss, and there's parts where Sundance is, you know, smarter and kind of like just taking the lead or whatever. In this, it's clearly a mentor-mentee relationship that, you know, Redford is playing younger in this than he played in Butch Cassidy. And that's a key to it. And Newman is playing older in this than he did in Butch Cassidy. And their relationship is kind of reflected both in the script and in the performances there. And I think that's one of the keys to this movie, is you have to understand that the whole way through. Newman is shown as fallible right from the start. You know, your introduction to him, he's passed out because he was on a bender. Mm-hmm. So you're thinking, oh, this guy could be, you know, a total screw up. But then as the movie goes on, you see more and more and more. He's just so on the ball with what's going on that, you know, you're just impressed by the way he presents. And you never feel like it's a cheat. You always feel like he really is that sharp and that he knows what he's doing. Again, a totally different dynamic between the two, and they both pull it off so well. And I think the key to that for me was watching them relatively closely in time, because I don't know if it would have stood out quite as much to me, but seeing them both within a couple of weeks of each other, it's like, wow, you know, this is, it's like two different actors or four different actors.
What was great in Butch Cassidy and Sundance was the fact that Sundance, because he was so dangerous with the guns and everything like that, that he was the protector. You know, you saw how you saw their relationship just a little bit differently off of that piece. Sundance, like, just had this dangerous competence about him, whereas Newman's character was kind of the heart. On this one, you could make the strong argument that Redford's character has kind of the heart to him, whereas Newman's character, who is you can still care greatly about, is more of the protector because he's more seasoned. And there's a certain point in time where he's the definitive protector of Redford's character in this one. And I like seeing the kind of the role reversal between the two of them in the parts that they're playing. Because, you know, with Redford being more of the lead in this one, we do get to see Newman kind of take the Sundance role. And I'm not saying by any stretch that these are cookie cutter roles, you know, from the two films, but it's nice seeing the two of them kind of swap spots in a very different story with very different characters, and just how well that worked. It does, from an ego standpoint, which is something you were referencing earlier, recognizing what's best for this film, and, you know, whether that was the actors and how they respected each other, script, directing, what all led to that, all of the pieces that went together to make this work, and keeping those egos in check, or that need to protect your brand in check, worked so well for this film, because I think it is one of those where everybody shined in it, no matter how big or small their role. And it, those two are really key reasons why. I mean, that you believe they're friends. You believe that in a very short period of time, these are people that actually care about each other. And it's the respect level. You feel it grow organically. We feel and believe in it as it goes along. Especially in key, there's some key pivotal moments that if they aren't in this film, if you don't have that shift in belief in that relationship, this film doesn't work as well. It's got the cool part at the end is because you want to see these two guys high five. You don't want to see one of them win. If you only see one of them win, something is lost in this. You got to want to believe that, you got to want to see both of them be victors at the end, you know, and go through that finish line, and you want to see them walk off together. That's the movie forces you to want that and need that. That's where I do, again, I go back to, I feel like this one, even more so than Butch and Sundance, which I love Butch and Sundance, by the way. So this isn't me kind of like wavering on which one's a better film or anything like that. It's this one, you feel a little differently about where you want the relationship to go because this film demands it. And I like the difference. It makes both films incredibly valid to watch.
I think what you're saying is totally valid, and I totally agree with what you're saying, but I think they do it in a very clever way or a very intelligent way, because although they do start out, you know, they have to feel each other out a little bit, you know, Redford's throwing him in the shower and, you know, it's getting, you know, dousing him because he's drunk, and Newman's, you know, kind of clearly bothered that he's not getting the respect at the level that he feels he deserves. So there's definitely that when it begins. And then as the movie goes on, they develop a very, very strong friendship and respect for each other. So you feel that. Again, everything in this movie feels organic as it goes on. There's nothing that just feels like, okay, they threw this at you and you have to accept it. And at the end of the movie, when they are successful, spoilers, by the way, when they are successful, they do have that moment where they're, you know, where they get to sit and talk for a moment and kind of be buddies. But then Redford, you know, walks off saying, okay, you know, I just wanted the satisfaction of doing this. I didn't need the money. I don't want my share. So there's just, again, just feels so good the way they put it all together. And I think just to get to the other part of this that I wanted to touch on, one of the keys to that is having the level of opponent that they do in this movie. And, you know, over the years, I feel like Robert Shaw was a chameleon, because it is hard to believe that this is the guy who played Red in From Russia with Love. It's hard to believe that this is the guy, more than anything else, who played Quint in Jaws. It's, you know, like, you can't see that this is the same guy. And if I didn't know it for a fact, I never would have realized that I was watching the same actor. He's that much of a chameleon in these roles. And he's threatening. You constantly have that feeling that he could explode at any moment and just pull out a gun and shoot you in the head. So, you know, you're afraid of him on one level for the characters. And yet, on the other hand, you want to see them take him down. His performance is masterful as the opponent in this movie. Now, that was the other casting thing that I saw, was the producers originally wanted Richard Boone of Have Gun Will Travel fame to play that part. And physically, I could see where he could be very similar to the way Shaw is presented in this movie. I thought Boone was a very good actor. So I could see him bringing a lot to the role. There's no way I could see him bringing as much as Shaw did, as far as that stuff that was under the skin, the stuff that wasn't actually scripted, that was all his performance. It's to me, it's an amazing performance.
The golf course sequence, when they're on the putting green and he's hanging out with his buddy, and he comes up and says that, "I have not captured Redford's character. You know, this did not happen here. We did kill the other guy. We sent the message. What do you want me to do?" Do you see him over there? If he finds out I let this street punk defeat me, I'm losing all my power. They're coming after me. We've got wars going on. And I loved everything about that. It was commanding. It shows I'm in the lead. I know the realities of the world that I'm in. I'm smart. I'm competent. This movie did not have, which sometimes when you do movies like this, because there's a need to drop humor in, you have that wah, wah, wah moment with the bad guy where they almost become too comedic. This one had a bad guy who, you mentioned dangerous before, and I was just like sitting here thinking, oh man, is he nailing exactly what I feel about this character? He is dangerous. And very, very, there is a charisma when he's in the room. There, even throughout the entire sequence, you know they are trying to play somebody who's next level. And if you don't believe that, what they actually do and what they accomplish in this does not matter as much. This film did a great job of establishing him. He is a terrific actor. And Chameleon, it was funny when you were saying that. I did not think about that with him before this. You're right. When he plays different roles, he is a different person on a level that you don't often see. You know, we're talking about Newman and Redford, right? And we're clearly identifying them. With him, he was Lonigan in this. I mean, completely Lonigan in this. And then when you see him in Jaws, to your point, I'm like, oh yeah, that is the same guy. And I mean, I know it's him. I mean, don't get me wrong. I know it's Robert Shaw, but I feel there's something different with him. And I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I'm walking away from this with a whole different viewpoint on him now, because of the fact that I think you're right on the chameleon aspect. And I don't think it's something you say about actors very often. Where you can say that you got your people like your Tom Cruises, for example. He's Tom Cruise in every role that he's in. That's not diminishing him. Really good actor and big films that he's, you know, been a lead on. But you always know it's him. Robert Shaw is not somebody that I typically reference in that capacity, because of the fact that he does his job so well.
it was one of the debates my dad and I used to have. Is I used to say that Robert De Niro was a great actor. And my dad said he's great at picking his parts, but Robert De Niro plays Robert De Niro in every movie he's in. And looking back on it, I kind of agree with my dad now, even though I used to debate him on it. Robert Shaw never plays the same part. I've never seen him in two different things where he seemed like the same guy. So there is definitely that, which I find fascinating. And, you know, my wife and I went to see the play by Ian Shaw, The Shark is Broken, where he plays his dad on the set of Jaws. And it's very fascinating to watch that whole dynamic as seen by his son, who does not paint him as the nicest guy. So it was very cool to watch that. And I just, again, I love his performance in this movie. One thing about the movie that I walked away and I still kind of shook my head, like scratched my head, I'll say, is the contract on Johnny Hooker. Celino, who's the one who everybody's afraid of, and you don't know who Celino is, you just know that Celino's on the job and that the other contract killers better watch out because Celino's not going to want them going after, you know, the mark that Celino was paid for. When we finally learn who Celino was, it seems to me like her effort to get Johnny Hooker was more convoluted than it needed to be. Mm-hmm. There were many, many points where she could have just taken him out and it would have been over. And I'm not exactly sure why it went to the level. You know, they give it a little lip service saying, well, you know, there were too many witnesses or whatever, but I'm not seeing it. I'm seeing, you know, there's a point where, you know, he's at her apartment and he sleeps over there. Now, there is the lady from across the hall who sees them, mm-hmm. but I don't know that that would stop her from just killing him and then going on, you know, going on her own way. So that was the only part of it that I'm not saying the script was wrong there. I'm just saying it didn't sit right with me. And maybe I could have understood it better if they had given it just a little bit more exposition to explain it.
You needed the moment in the diner with them. You know, you need the moment where he's seeing her and her job and you see the connection where he's like, oh, maybe this is the one, because he hasn't had that female lead that with him in this one. And we've seen some great moments. You mentioned Sally Kirkland and her role and everything. But I actually really liked that he didn't have that one girl, because it set up the reason why he was attracted to Celino when it happens. So we're there. We've seen like his relationships kind of not be that the one yet. So that part was pretty pivotal. You need the sequence in the street where he's going towards her, like he smiles and his guard's down, because it's her and they've had that moment. So I feel that, but I think you're right. The stuff, like the journey beyond that in between is a little awkward. But you do need those two pivotal bookended moments. And I felt like those worked. I don't know that we needed it to be quite as jagged as it was to get there. But the moment in the street is such a pivotal scene because it sets this sequence where he has to look at Newman's character in a different way. We know he's already there. But for us as the viewer to see that moment where we know the FBI is trying to get him to turn, right? And you don't want to see that happen. It adds an exclamation point to that can't happen. When he walks in and takes a look at Newman after that whole sequence plays down, because the dramatic shot of her getting shot in the head, knowing that he was going to die otherwise, is such an important part to that relationship, where at that point we love them together. We love Newman and Redford together. That is one of those key sequences that leads to it. So the Celino bit works in what it's supposed to do. I'm with you though that I don't know that it needed to be quite as involved and intricate as it was, because I think at the end of the day you just need those two bookended moments and something in between. And because it doesn't take away, I agree with everything you're saying about it being a little awkward as far as how we get there. I don't know that we needed all of that in order to get the same moment that we needed, because really what you're looking for from that is you need this for Newman and Redford, we already had it cemented, but man, did that put an exclamation point on it. When those two, when he looks at Redford, when Redford looks at Newman, that's acting. When he walks in, you see the fondness is at a different level. He recognizes what he did, and Newman's reaction back to him. Oh my gosh, no words. It is the look between the two of them. They convey so much emotion in those looks, and he feels very different than the other times they've looked at each other in the film. And I love that sense of this relationship has evolved. That to me is acting talent, where they're making you feel something is so real that you are now believing in these two people and the relationship that's there. And that part was so cool, spinning out of all that. So Celino, the Celino concept worked from that perspective.
Yeah, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't at least just give lip service a little bit just to the supporting cast in this, because it's got a very large supporting cast. We have Ray Walston, we have Charles Durning, we have Eileen Brennan, we have Harold Gould, and a dozen other people who are all worth seeing. I have my one piece of trivia on this that I like to mention is the train conductor, the one who gets Gondorf into the poker game, is Larry Mann, and he is noted as being the voice of Yukon Cornelius in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Yes.
So he had a part in one of my favorite things ever, and it's worth mentioning. I don't know if there's anybody there that you want to single out or mention, but they were all, they all just added to the tapestry of this movie, as far as I'm concerned. They gave it more depth. They gave it more feeling like it was reality. And again, there's a bunch of other character actors and small parts that do that. So I don't know that in the format we work that we have time to go through all of them.
I've got one I'd like to note. Dana Elkar as
the FBI agent, or the faux FBI agent, which I was shocked that my wife immediately had never seen this movie, and she immediately said, "That's a scam."
And I didn't view it that way. So good on her, you know, as far as catching that. When I first watched this movie, and honestly, it had been so long since I'd seen it, I was like remembering what goes on with the FBI agent. How did that go? As I was watching it through, he plays a really good role because he looks so top level FBI, where it's all business, that I was believing once again that he was an FBI agent. I loved the turn and I loved where it worked. Good on her that she caught it. I will admit they swerved me on that again. And I think he played a really key role in this, whether you catch it or not. I think it's one of those things where I love that part of the scam. And yeah, it sets the stage for the ending. I'm glad I kudos on her for catching it. I'm glad I didn't, because it made the ending scene sweeter. Well,
the key to that performance isn't you believing that he's an FBI agent.
Right.
The key to that is you believing that Lieutenant Snyder believes he's an FBI agent.
Yes.
So if you see through the scam, as my wife did, which I was impressed by that, as I said, because I wouldn't have seen it, you know, at any point in my life. If I had never seen this movie before, there's no way I would have picked that out. But it's just the same. It's still believable that Snyder believes it. Yeah. And Johnny Hooker's performance there. So now we have Robert Redford acting as Johnny Hooker, acting for the scam, and it's all just put together so well, and it's, again, it's believable even if you see through it. So yes, that's a key. And then at the end when that happens, you know, you see the double cross developing with the gambling and how they're going to get Lonergan, but you don't see that coming. Even if you saw that the FBI agent wasn't right, I don't think you saw the ultimate twist of, you know, they're going to pretend to kill each other. But it goes back again, you know, Chekhov's gun. When Gondorf is telling Hooker that, you know, this is it, you know, you have to be satisfied with it. You know, once it's done, you can't come back and say it's not enough, I want more. And he said, the guy who you're scamming can't even know that you scammed him. And that's what that does. That's what that FBI angle does to it.
Yes.
And again, it's a Chekhov's gun thing, because you don't know how they're going to do that ultimately, but it's beautifully put together. And then we get the closing music of, you know, Back to the Entertainer, which is just so well put placed. And this movie won Best Picture, and it won Best Director, and it won Best Score. So, you know, all well deserved as far as I'm concerned.
Hooker at the end not taking the money, or, you know, not caring about the money. He walked out with Gondorf at the end and just kind of like, I'm just going to blow it anyway. He wanted the score. The score meant everything to him, having that big score. And it was just, it was, there was something, it's that weird romanticism about the thievery and everything that was in there that was so cool.
His not taking the money is part of his character arc.
Yes.
That he's not about the money now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know they're moving on to do more scams or whatever. And sadly, they wrote a sequel to this that starred Mac Davis and Jackie Gleason, which I have never seen, but I've heard awful things about, and I don't believe I ever will see it.
Don't watch it.
Have you seen it?
Oh, yes. Or others think maybe some point in time we'll watch it, because we're it might be fun to talk about.
sometimes it's fun to talk about the bad things as much as it is, yes, to talk about the good ones. So unless you have any other points, I think we can give the rating that our audience is already going to know that we're giving.
Yeah, I'm sure we can at this point. Yes.
Okay, so I've gone through my life for the last, you know, whatever it is, 50 years, feeling like I love both Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and The Sting, but that the world got it wrong, and that Butch Cassidy is the better movie that should have won Best Picture. Looking at these as a reviewer and looking at them through a critic's eyes and looking at them close in time, which I don't think I ever did before, saw them both, you know, in relatively short fashion. I think, nostalgia aside, this is probably, I can't even say definitively, but probably the better movie. And it's enjoyable, as far as I'm concerned, on every level. I think, except for my little bit of confusion, my little bit of saying, huh, about the whole Salino thing and how it went down, I think this is pretty much a perfect movie. And I'm not sure the Salino part takes away from that. You know, it's just that I had some confusion about it. I'm not sure that it's wrong in the way it's presented. It's just that it left me with some confusion. So I have that. But otherwise, I think this, like I said, is nearly a perfect movie. And I think it absolutely gets a Jaws rating. And I don't think anybody could ever convince me otherwise.
It's funny. I think we're in similar places. I mean, obviously, I'm saying it's Jaws, but I think one of the things I'm amazed about is why it's Jaws for me on this one. I just remember loving this film and everything that it did. But this time around, it really struck me again how cool this movie is, how cool the characters are. And I will say, I referenced on this film, this particular conversation about how I felt like I was part of the gang. That was something more this time around when I watched it, that I noticed that more. And it is just, it is on a short list now for me, that if it wasn't with our Desert Isle movies, I'll tell you right now, you guys all just heard one of my revisions. This film needs to be in my top five, because it was so cool to watch this again. I'm glad you suggested this, because it's a treat to watch this movie again. It was a treat to have a conversation around this movie. If you have not seen this, please, anything we spoiled for you on this thing, the execution in this film is everything. It does not matter what that you know where this thing's going to go. It is getting there. If you've never experienced this ride, jump on this train and enjoy this movie, because this is one of those that I think having a Jaws movie like this one and pointing it out to people, or we're doing people a service if they haven't seen this one before, because you're missing something.
Agreed. Totally. I guess that's it for The Sting. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you, Sean, for doing this with me, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
I'll bet three. Call, raise 200. Call. No.
I'm out.
Call. Ace is over.
Three cowboys.
All red, queen high. Well, it finishes me. Don't worry about it, pal.
They wouldn't let you in here if you weren't a chump. Lombard will be joining you in a couple of minutes.
Now, look here, Shaw.
I've had enough of this game and quite enough of this company. Check me out, Mr. Clemens.
I guess that just leaves the three of us.
Yes, Mr. Shaw. Just leaves us three. Mr. Clayton, I think we should take a break for 5 minutes. Tempers seem to be running a little
high. Oh, come on, Linneman. I'm just starting to do good.
Stack me a cooler, Fry.
Come on, Joe. We'll be in the station in another hour. The other guys are the big losers. You're still okay.
Fix me a deck, threes and nines. I'll cut it in on Clayton's deal.
What do you want Clayton to get?
Nothing. I want him out of there earlier. I'm going to bust that bastard bookie in one play.
$400 to you, Mr. Jameson. You're even.
This wasn't my night.
Where's your auntie?
Have I had anything? You stayed in front of me, Joe. You know?
$500.
Here, five. 1,000.
I'll fold. I'll play.
Cards?
Two.
Three.
Here, 500 and 1,000.
Your 1,000, I'll raise you 2,000.
Your 2,000. Mr. Clemens, give me $10,000 more.
I'll call.
4-9.
Four jacks.
You owe me 15 grand, pal.
Must have left my wallet in my room.
Don't hand me any of that crap. When you come to a game like this, you bring your money. How do I know you won't take a powder?
No, not
all right, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll send a boy around to your room in 5 minutes. You better have the money, or it's going to be all around Chicago that you're welched. You won't be able to get a game of jacks. Cash me in for the rest of these problems.